the significance of knowledge-based production in Iran's economy. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has named the current Iranian year 1401, corresponding to 2022, as the year of production, knowledge-based manufacturing and job creation. Please stay with us for more. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has chosen production and manufacturing as the key phrase in at least five of the mottos and slogans that he chose to name various years recently. On other occasions, production and manufacturing was certainly implied or indirectly referred to in the chosen motto. For example, 2018 was designated as the year of supporting Iranian goods and commodities. Certainly, the motto implies support for Iran's production and manufacturing sector. Thus, the leader of the Islamic Revolution regards production and manufacturing as the most important way to counter the economic war that is being waged against the Islamic Republic by our enemies. Industrialized nations have invariably focused on manufacturing and production in their chosen paths to economic success. The Norwegian economist Erik S. Reinert, in his book How Rich Countries Got Rich and Why Poor Countries Stay Poor, says quite clearly that all rich industrialized countries, today and in the past few centuries, possess a powerful and high-quality manufacturing sector. This is the key to creation of wealth. Undoubtedly, production and manufacturing has been a key element of wealth creation in all industrialized nations, such as Britain in the 19th century, the United States, Germany and Japan, and the former Soviet Union in the 20th century, and in more recent years, in countries such as South Korea, Taiwan and China. Another important point to note is that manufacturing and production is the key to reducing unemployment. Most jobs are connected either directly or indirectly to the manufacturing sector. In 2005, the manufacturing sector accounted for 20.2% of Japan's economy, 23.2% of Germany's economy, and 13.4% of the US economy. If the relative size of the manufacturing sector in the United States was as large as it is in Germany, this would have meant an extra 10 million well-paid and high-quality jobs for American workers. If the relative size of the U.S. manufacturing sector was as large as it is in Japan, this would have meant an extra 7 million high-quality jobs for American workers. Another important point to note is that a thriving manufacturing sector means more money in the pockets of workers and less pressure on ordinary people. By imposing tough sanctions against Iran, the enemies of the Islamic Revolution have tried to cause a rift between the government and the people of Iran by increasing inflation and reducing ordinary people's purchasing power. A thriving manufacturing sector, however, creating more jobs, is the perfect antidote to this foreign economic venom. A thriving manufacturing sector translates into less economic pressure on ordinary people. Furthermore, trade between nations is based upon manufacturing and production, and not services. Although the service sector is also significant economically, manufacturing is more important. The current Iranian government, known as the 13th government, has decided to boost trade with all of Iran's neighbors. A key plank of Iran's foreign policy is to strengthen relations with neighboring countries and to increase trade with neighboring states. This year's motto, the Year of Production, Knowledge-Based Manufacturing and Job Creation, places a lot of emphasis on knowledge-based production and knowledge-based manufacturing. The leader has said, in order for the economy to grow and to achieve economic reform, we must move decisively towards a knowledge-based economy. But what is a knowledge-based economy? A precise and succinct answer is that in a knowledge-based economy, advanced science and technology plays a very important role in all aspects of manufacturing and production. The knowledge economy is an economic system in which the production of goods and services is based principally on knowledge-intensive activities that contribute to advancement in technical and scientific innovation. A knowledge-based economy features a highly skilled workforce within the microeconomic and macroeconomic environment. Institutions and industries create jobs that demand specialized skills in order to meet the global market needs. Knowledge is viewed as an additional input to labor and to capital. Thus, a knowledge-based economy reduces the costs of manufacturing and production and increases efficiency and productivity. Goods and commodities produced in a knowledge-based economy are of a higher quality and are able to compete in the global market. Manufactured goods in such an economy are competitive globally and have excellent quality. Under conditions where the Islamic Republic of Iran faces sanctions and economic pressure from the outside, it makes sense to go for knowledge-based manufacturing in this country. This will undoubtedly reduce pressure from the outside and make sanctions ineffective. Rather than selling raw materials with little or no added value, we must use high technology and innovation to manufacture high quality and high added value products, creating wealth and earning hard currencies. A knowledge-based economy makes us more competitive. It improves our trade balance with the rest of the world and gives us soft power as well. Well, dear listeners, we have come to the end of this program. Goodbye and God bless.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss about the problems, questions and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Professor Salman Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al Mustafa University and also a researcher on the Islamic issues in the Hawza Ilmi Afqa. Well, dear scholar, we talked about the relationships that we need to guide our children. There were relationships about self, relationship with others, relationship with wilaya, and how wilaya encompasses the relationship with environment you discussed in the previous session. Now, we would want to know more about the relationship with environment.
So, yes, as I mentioned, that we need to understand that we want to develop a very beautiful society.
Yeah.
When we talk about living in this world, Imam Ali alayhi salam has been quoted as saying that he said that live in this world as you are going to live here forever.
All right.
Ish fi dunya kama ta'ishu fiha abada. We have to live in this world in such a way that you want to live here forever.
All right.
But be ready to depart as if your death is coming tomorrow.
All right.
That is the essence of zuhd in Islam.
All right.
Our imams command from us that we live in this world in such a manner, we develop it, we harness it, we manage it in such a way that
we're going to live here forever.
Forever. But we're not attached to it. We are ready to depart for our heavenly abode and meet our Lord any time. But whilst we are here, we should do the best things that are possible.
All right. So,
environment, if we do not take care of the environment, how are we going to live a healthy life in it?
Yeah.
So we need to protect the environment. The environment, the ecology. We have non-living things, we have living things, we have non-living things in the form of the earth itself, land, sea, air, the rivers, mountains, forests, jungles.
Yeah.
Then we have the living things, the plants, forests. Of course, forests and these things would fall here. The ocean, the water, animals, fish, whatever, animals, and other, and of course, beyond that also, we're not just looking at those things which are apparent. Maybe there are so many forces beyond this hidden.
Every small and big creature.
Everything that God has created, we have a relation. We have to maintain a relationship, even the angels.
Okay.
So we need to develop that relationship, maintain it. Number one, land, sea, air, they should not be polluted.
Yeah.
Whatever pollution is taking place has to be stopped, has to be managed. Then more than that, it's discovering what the planet Earth holds in its bosoms. The whole of the universe, we need to discover that. We need to understand. Because in the Holy Quran, as I understand, when the Holy Quran says, سَخَّرَ لَكُمْ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا مِّنْهُ, that Allah Almighty has created the whole of the universe for mankind and to put it at its disposal, in its control and under his command.
Yeah.
He says, I have created you for myself and I have created the whole of the world for you.
Exactly.
So we need to manage it. We need to discover it. We need to understand it.
Yeah. We'll talk more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Brother Nakavi with us. And we are discussing about the relationship that needs to be developed with the environment. Yes, Brother.
As I said, that we need to understand the environment, whatever exists beyond us as the human race. We have the whole planet Earth at our disposal. Beyond that, the planets, the galaxies. It's a huge, huge, infinite universe which we need to discover.
All right. So there's
and whenever
not just...
Allah Almighty talks about his signs.
Yeah.
سَنُرِيهِمْ آيَاتِنَا فِي الْآفَاقِ وَفِي أَنفُسِهِمْ حَتَّى يَتَبَيَّنَا لَهُمْ أَنَّهُ الْحَقِّ
Yeah.
Our relationship with the environment is huge, is immense. Allah says that I am showing you my signs in the heavens and within your souls.
True.
We need to discover those signs.
Exactly.
The discovery of those signs is through philosophizing and through science. Philosophy and science go hand in hand to understand the universe in its totality.
All right.
And in its particular specific areas.
All right.
Philosophy talks about the universe as a whole.
So what you're trying to say over here is that just teaching your child to whatever you eat, just throw the disposals into the dustbin and use less water, save trees. This is not enough, and do not pollute air, water.
That is just a part of it. I mean,
that's very small portion small of things. It. That's not the only relationship that needs to be developed.
It has to be beyond that.
It's beyond that. Now you need to teach your children how to explore in the universe.
Exactly. That's very good. I mean, pollution, as you very rightly mentioned, taking care of how you manage the water, how you use water, how you use the various resources of the planet.
Yeah.
You don't litter your society. Everything that is necessary has to be taught to our children. It has to be inculcated. And we have to lead as... I mean, you can't expect your child to not to litter the playground that he's playing in when you yourself are throwing away...
Exactly.
Things on the ground without taking care of, you know, there's a bucket, there's a dustbin or whatever. So many places don't even have that.
Yeah.
But that has to be taught and inculcated. But beyond that is the exploration of the society.
Exploring the universe.
I mean, the child should, from the day one, should be able to understand and explore and discover. He has to have an inquisitive mind,
yeah,
a curiosity for understanding what is beyond us. He should be able to explore the universe. But that has to be understood under the light, as I said, hatta yatabayyana lahum annahu al-haq.
Yeah.
The child must understand that these are the signs of Allah.
These are the signs of Allah.
And we have
Allah,
to,
actually,
as
yeah.
a result of that, we have to understand that He is the truth. Allah Almighty is the absolute truth.
Is the truth.
He
yeah.
is the true reality behind everything.
Yeah. Now, how we can inculcate that scientific nature in our children? I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said, It is a recommended practice for a child to play in his childhood so that he becomes patient in his adulthood.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Professor Salman Nakawi with us, and we're talking about the relationship with environment that needs to be taught to children. You said that beyond teaching our children about taking care of environment, not polluting the environment, we need to develop this scientific nature in our children that you need to explore the universe, and in that exploration, you need to find out the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
True, yes. You're mentioning the word science. I agree with that. Exploring the universe is a scientific discovery. But before scientific discovery, we have certain types of understanding or mental processes or thinking which comes before science.
True.
And some things which cannot be experimented upon. For example, when we want our child to become Newton. Newton saw an apple fall from the tree to the ground, and then he hypothesized, why is it falling down? He was questioning, his mind was inquisitive. He said there must be a cause for it. There must be a reason for it.
Yeah.
So he says then is a result of gravity,
force,
for example.
Yeah.
He theorizes about the gravitational force and then goes on to prove it.
Yeah.
But the very question that why should we be looking for a cause?
Yeah.
Is something which is of a foundational nature, which is there in our minds, which has to be accepted before we go for the reason.
Yeah.
That there's a cause for every happening.
Yeah.
Is something philosophical.
All right.
It is beyond experimentation. You can't prove this. You cannot prove this by experimentation.
All right.
You have to accept it before that.
All right.
That's the philosophical type of reasoning, like you carry out in mathematics.
Yeah.
Mathematics is a very important tool that our children need to learn before even carrying out scientific discovery. Mathematics has a very important, it's the language of science.
Yeah.
But before mathematics, there's logic.
Yeah.
And before logic, there's philosophy.
Yeah.
All of this has to be inculcated and taught to the child. You can't just talk about science and
skip all the other things. Okay.
So there needs to be
reason, there needs to be logic, there needs to be everything that
reasoning is of many types: inductive reasoning, deductive reasoning. These have to be developed in the child from the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, when we talk about science and religion,
yeah,
where we are making there's a problem there.
Okay.
And that starts from childhood. That has to be resolved at the very onset.
Over the very beginning.
That is important. This is how we how should we do that? We need to talk about that.
All right, and I would definitely want to know that, and many listeners might be curious about that. We'll talk on that, inshallah, in another session. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. You can go to the tab Call of Islam, and out there, you can search Islamic Upbringing and you'll find all our episodes over there. Thank you so much for being with us once again. And in case you have any questions, you have any issues, you have any anything you want to ask about the Islamic upbringing of your children, you can feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, fi amanallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Oh!
Nairobi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Nairobi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Nairobi English Radio.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
We were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, I'm sorry, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation. I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Probably. Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout. But
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there, too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, but these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless, so...
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that it's just something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing, and he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun, they all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together with a code of silence and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters, police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working people of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
A state of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But, I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York. But with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
Difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that what the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. The military-grade equipment should be used in active shooter situation, terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians. But never, ever, they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police when in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on, I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn, there'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched, my mother was involved in activism work, and so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil, and just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow, to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. And that's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
The Black Lives Matter movement, sparked by incidents of police violence, is an ideological and political movement fighting for black empowerment and equality. The movement has grown from the hashtag Black Lives Matter to include protests and demonstrations in every major city in America.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
The notorious Guantanamo Bay prison is an ample proof that the United States is a terrorist regime. Reports of torture and violation of human rights in this infamous prison is indicative of the fact that the U.S. is the biggest sponsor of state terrorism. If the United States wants to counter terrorism, instead of waging endless wars around the world and causing civilian deaths and destruction, it should start from itself. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. The title of this article is Guantanamo Proof of U.S. Being a Terrorist Regime. Stay with us, please. The website of Crescent International has recently wrote, given the degree of ignorance among most Americans, it is safe to assume that many would not know what Guantanamo Bay represents or where it is located. Even if they knew, most would not care. After all, their heads have been stuffed with such vile propaganda about the threat of terrorism that they have come to believe those held there deserve what to be punished. Opened in January 2002, a few months after 9/11 attacks, at its peak it held 779 prisoners. They were the worst of the worst. In the infamous words of Donald Rumsfeld, "Worms have probably consumed his stinking body by now as he awaits his rightful place in the lowest depth of hell. But more than 20 years after it was opened, Guantanamo Bay still holds 36 detainees as of July 25th, 2022. Only a handful, less than 10 men, are charged with involvement in 9/11 attacks, but their trials have not been held even at the Kangaroo Military Tribunal. Most of the rest are either cleared for release or await judgment on their release. They have not been charged with any crime. Guantanamo represents American lawlessness at its worst. According to the United Nations, such detentions have always triggered controversies over legality. Not only does the U.S. illegally occupy Cuban territory, but most detainees have not been tried according to U.S. laws. Further, international human rights organizations have not been allowed to visit the facility, again in clear violation of international law and the Geneva Conventions. 2 days after he was sworn in as President of the United States in January 2009, Barack Obama signed the 13,492 executive order. It was titled Review and Disposition of Individuals Detained at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base and Closure of Detention Facilities. Its intended aim was to close the torture camp permanently. During his 8 years in office, Obama was able to reduce the number of detainees from 277 in 2008 to 91 in 2016, but he was unable to close it. American general threatened him with dire consequences if he closed Guantanamo Bay. Even Joe Biden, who served as Obama's vice president, vowed to close the torture camp, but it still remains open. Away from the prying eyes of journalists as well as human rights organizations, American soldiers and CIA agents have inflicted horrific torture on innocent people. Euphemistically called enhanced interrogation technique, torture was widespread. Sleep deprivation, holding detainees in stressful positions, and other forms of barbaric practices were routinely inflicted on the detainees. Their only crime was to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. To get a glimpse into what the detainees suffered, a few examples would suffice. Omar Khadr, captured in eastern Afghanistan in July 2002, he was shot twice in the chest by American occupation troops and barely survived. He was moved to Bagram Air Base, which served as America's first torture location. While his wounds were still raw, Khadr, 15 at the time, was subjected to brutal torture. In October 2002, he was chained to the floor of a U.S. transport plane in extremely stressful position and shipped to Guantanamo Bay. His real torture began there because he was accused of being an Al-Qaeda child. Every soldier took turns to inflict their own punishment on him. Even the Canadian government, led by the racist Stephen Harper at the time, joined in inflicting harm on him. Had it not been for Khadr, lawyers Dennis Edney and Nate Whitling, he would still be languishing in Guantanamo. Brought to Canada in 2012 under a plea bargain, Khadr won his release in 2015 and received $10.5 million in compensation from the Canadian government in 2017 for violating his charter rights. He was guilty of nothing. He was the victim of American barbarism, aided and abetted by the likes of Harper and his right-wing anti-Muslim bigots. And we have other examples, including Saifullah Paracha. The 74-year-old Pakistani businessman was captured in Thailand in 2003 and brought to Guantanamo in September 2004. He was accused of being an Al-Qaeda facilitator because he had exchanged money for two of the alleged hijackers that he did not know. Would a grocery store owner be charged if the alleged hijackers had brought groceries there? Pracha was cleared for release last year after his son, Ozair, also accused of terrorism, had his charges thrown out by a New York judge in March 2020. Allegations against Ozair as well as his father were based on confessions extracted under torture from detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The son was sent to his native Pakistan. The elderly Pracha, suffering from multiple ailments, has still not been released, even though the review board declared that he was no longer a threat to the U.S. He never was. And Abu Zubaydah was subjected to the most brutal forms of torture. He was captured in August 2002 by FBI, CIA, and General Pervez Musharraf Intelligence Agency in Faisalabad. Abu Zubaydah was accused of a laundry list of terrorist acts. Donald Rumsfeld said he was, if not the number two, very close to the number two person in Al-Qaeda. The Central Intelligence Agency informed Assistant Attorney General Jay Bai that he served as Osama bin Laden's senior lieutenant. In that capacity, he has managed a network of training camps. He also acted as Al-Qaeda coordinator of external contacts and foreign communications. CIA Director Michael Hayden would tell the press in 2008 that 25% of all the information his agency had gathered about Al-Qaeda from human sources originated with one other detainee and him. George W. Bush would use his case to justify the CIA's enhanced interrogation program, claiming that he had run a terrorist camp in Afghanistan where some of the 9/11 hijackers trained and that he helped smuggle Al-Qaeda leaders out of Afghanistan so they would not be captured by U.S. military forces. But as Rebecca Gordon exposes in her brilliant article in Counterpunch, none of it was true. During the operation to capture him, Abu Zubaydah was severely injured, shot in the thigh and stomach. Without immediate medical attention, he would have died, but the CIA wanted him alive, so it flew in an American surgeon to patch him up. The agency's concern was not humanitarian. The CIA wanted him alive to be able to interrogate him, hoping to extract information from him. Ms. Gordon reveals that Abu Zubaydah had the dubious luck to be the subject of a number of CIA firsts. The first post-9/11 prisoner to be waterboarded, the first to be experimented on by psychologists working as CIA contractors, one of the first of the agency's ghost prisoners, detainees hidden from the world, including International Committee of the Red Cross, which under the Geneva Conventions must be allowed access to every prisoner of war, and one of the first prisoners to be cited in a memo written by Jay Bybee for the Bush administration on what the CIA could legally do to a detainee without supposedly violating U.S. federal laws against torture. While he was accused of all kinds of misdemeanors, his real crime was that in 1980s, he helped run the Khaldun camp. This was a training facility set up in Afghanistan with CIA help during the Soviet occupation of that country. In other words, Abu Zubaydah was like Osama bin Laden, an American ally in the fight against the Soviets. Abu Zubaydah's horrific torture, including